you can't replace prototyping. So like the different roles that I've had in the past, that prototyping is fundamental to some of those roles. And then simulation is like the death of prototyping in other roles, because the simulation's coming on so fast. And it's been interesting for me having a breadth of roles to be able to like, okay, in this case, like I actually do need to prototype, and I need to hold the thing, and I need to look at it, and we need to paint it, and we need to give it to a customer to use it.
So, hey guys, what is up? Rob Irwin back again with another episode of Designing in the Wild. I have been playing schedule tag with Andre Brown for a little bit, and super excited to finally get a hold of you, Andre. How have you been?
Fully recovered from a broken hip, but other than that, I'm all well. Yes.
Oh my gosh! Well, so from all the activity we were talking about earlier, you were doing with all the new store and the kiddos, it sounds like. You're putting the new hip to good use. Or not the
yeah,
new
I'm
one,
getting
the,
old, you
the fixed
see.
One.
Getting old, like as soon as you start breaking hips, you know that you're getting old.
Exactly. Well, for everybody out there who doesn't know, Andre and I worked together at Amazon back when we were designing the dash cart, but he is now the principal engineer for Amazon and transportation sustainability. He's the chief engineer for innovation over there. And you've risen the ranks since I've known you, Andre, from the past 3 or 4 years when we were working on the dash cart. What are you guys working on right now, if you could talk about it at all?
So I am working on trying to make our middle mile transportation fleet more efficient and sustainable, with a specific focus on trying to enable zero emission vehicles. And most of my focus initially has been on the design of the aerodynamic components that go onto our existing fleet. It's kind of a short term, like try and improve your current product by making it more efficient, use less fuel. As they move to alternative fuels, efficiency, fuels cost a little bit more. The technology costs a little bit more, and they need to get those sunk costs back again through efficiency improvements. So, it's about reducing the amount of fuel used, which reduces the cost, which reduces the carbon emissions. And so that, there's a lot of simulation and working with suppliers to get aerodynamic parts fitted to hundreds of trucks that are going out every year. These are new trucks and retrofitted trucks. So,
right. Yeah, I'm guessing there's a challenge there with the different models and makes and whatnot for compatibility.
Yeah, we typically buy from more than one source. It's a common practice, and it just means that you can scale really quickly. And so certainly with Amazon, fleet is growing really, really quickly, and being able to have two different trucks or three different trucks just allows you to to go at the speed that you need to go at. But it does present problems when designing components for those trucks, because every cab is a different geometry, every chassis is different, all the boxes are different, you've got different so you've got different truck OEMs, different box OEMs, different trailer OEMs, and then add on top of that you've got component suppliers, which are typically smaller suppliers that are trying to design skirts and fairings and devices that reduce drag. And then so you're layering all of these different variations, and so you have to have a really very, very lucky with AWS that we're able to run all the simulations in-house. So we're doing aerodynamic CFD simulation, and we can take all of these different various designs and then do, well, what happens if you run with fairing A versus fairing B, and what happens if you run on this route versus that route, and you can do a big design of experiments that gets you to some really meaningful data that you can get really quickly, because we've got this amazing compute that scales to whatever you throw at it. You can just Like we're running with hundreds of millions of cells.
Well, that's so that drives down your kind of analysis time as well. And I'm guessing, given the economies of scale for distribution and different types of trucks, you're able to kind of retrofit, like as you mentioned, different iterations of different fairings and different designs across all the permutations, and come out on top with the best.
We're doing simulations now with upwards of 200 million cells, and we're running it on, over 1,000 cores in parallel. So that, these are massive supercomputers, and we can run, I'm running half a dozen different geometries all in parallel. So, you've got this massive resource that you can switch on, and we're doing simulations that would have taken a week, to run just one simulation, and we're doing half a dozen overnight in 12 hours. So it,
Oh my
you know,
God.
that this is, just the answers that you can get and the fidelity that you can get in the simulations.
Wow.
It allows you to, I would say it allows you to skip the step of prototyping to try and work out what you want to do. And this is a general theme of mine. I've been involved a lot in prototyping and simulation, and in some cases you are able to skip that initial prototype step and go straight to like something that you can go and test on the road, real data. And in other cases, like there's absolutely no, you can't replace prototyping. So like the different roles that I've had in the past, that prototyping is fundamental to some of those roles, and then simulation is like the death of prototyping in other roles because the simulation's coming on so fast. It's been interesting for me having a breadth of roles to be able to like, okay, in this case, like I actually do need to prototype, and I need to hold the thing, and I need to look at it, and we need to paint it, and we need to give it to a customer to use it. And my current role, it's more the opposite. It's okay, let's do a really high fidelity simulation and skip the step of prototyping and go straight to, okay, let's deploy to 600 trucks and collect real data for how they perform in the field. And then get better again for next year because there's another 600 coming next year, or whatever the number is.
That's super interesting. I know that I definitely agree with you. There's definitely some hands-on involvement with prototyping that I think a lot of things that require, or concepts, features that require hands-on prototyping, maybe skew towards maybe the more human interaction and behavioral stuff, maybe ergonomics and human factors. And you're talking about fluid dynamics and air and just geometries on automobiles, and so that definitely makes sense to spit those out quick and get your answers quick. Now, I'm curious, are you using off the shelf like fairings and things like that, or are you then going to model in customs and have those built and tested?
So it's a bit of a new muscle for Amazon, really. Like the transportation division is relatively young as a group within Amazon, and the pace at which it's growing has meant that they've relied on OEMs. So from a design perspective, initially we're just leveraging existing supply chains, and we're in the very first deployments, we're saying, okay, look, what can we get that catches the procurement schedule? And so we're analyzing what's on the market, and then we're making some selections, and we're learning from that. At the same time, we're looking to influence the design for the following year. So working with those same suppliers,
I see.
we are looking to say, okay, well, we've got this great simulation capability, and we've got some ideas for different shape fairings, or we want to use some, we want to use some machine learning to help us iterate the form, to come up with a lower drag shape that might not have been conceived by a designer. And then working with those suppliers to say, okay, let's prototype and test in, a small batch trial for the following year. So it's a little bit of a little bit of both, but we're not at the moment trying to, run before we, we're walking, and we're not standing up a whole facility at this stage for, like doing our own thing. We're more about like, let's go quickly and influence what we can buy today and try and improve what we can buy today. And then, see what we learn and how we can apply that to the future.
Yeah, I was always enamored with the speed at which Amazon moves. And, I know that there's a lot of corporations and companies out there that try to move quickly. And this brings me to a thought about ambiguity in the design process. And I know that, with these simulations, it really helps to funnel the questions quite quickly. And I know that you have some history with previously working at Shark and made some work at Dyson and such, and you alluded to the prototyping side of things on the flip to kind of running simulations. I'm wondering if you could talk about how you, in your mind, balance the level of ambiguity across a project. Well, let me rephrase it. Like the level of ambiguity with, let's say, a vacuum design, vacuum cleaner design. I know you can engineer, simulate the flow analysis and all sorts of a number of other things. But when it comes to like the behavioral aspect of developing prototypes in maybe a realm such as Shark or new R&D there, talk to me about kind of how you think through balancing that and why is it important to kind of get these models in real world aspects quickly?
So, like, in retrospect, having worked in through no specific choice, I just kind of ended up working in the vacuum cleaner industry. Like, I had studied automotive engineering and went for a job at Dyson, and they were talking about doing an electric car, and I ended up doing robot vacuum cleaners. And that was really my introduction to product design, right? I didn't study it at university or anything. And I'm absolutely amazed looking back on it at how multidisciplinary, just designing something as simple as a vacuum cleaner is. And it really is like the complexity of it when you're looking at trying to innovate or to improve the state of the art. You've got so many factors that come and compete for your attention when you're in the ideas phase. So some of those things are like, hey, I want to make sure that I'm, clear of IP that is pre-existing, or that I create IP, right? There's a whole, right. What can you do? What can you create that's protectable? That's one set of pressures that impinges on the design process. The second is like, you've got this product team that, is trying to define a marketing message and has got a whole set of criteria about what will and won't sell, right? They've got extensive experience. They've got supplier relationships, big box stores that are going to say, okay, well, you've improved it by 18%, but really that's nothing, right? Like, we can't write 18% better on the box. You have to get to 50% better, right? So like,
before market shifts.
So you need to think about your new designs based on like trying to meaningfully improve some metric or another, and then you come back to the question of like, which metrics are important, right? And so there's some metrics that are important from an engineer's perspective that then knock on, define the shape and the air path and the motor and the things like this. So you might be like, okay, well, we need, marketing wants to be able to write the most powerful XYZ. And so you need to be able to deliver that from an engineering perspective. And that means that your air pathways need to be low pressure drop, and that means that your motors have to be high efficiency, and they want to have a long runtime, so they need to use less power per, we used to call it air watts, but it's kind of a measure of the air power, and and but you can't have too many batteries because it gets too heavy, and like there's all these competing technical things. And then layering on top of that, there's all of the user of the product, the person that you're designing it for. They care about some aspects of the design, and they really don't care about other aspects, right? And so you get into the questions of like, well, this is a cleaning product. It should probably, you know, you should probably make sure that it does its primary primary purpose really well.
Yeah.
But it needs to be usable. It needs to be ergonomic. It needs to be lightweight. It needs to be beautiful. You know, especially vacuum cleaners are starting to be left out and about more, so that they're, you know, there's a whole shift towards convenience. And so, you know, these softer kind of metrics, like how do you define convenience? Well, you probably have to go and make some things and, you know, talk to some people and let them try it. And that forces you to prioritize some of those, you know, harder to define metrics. And I think for me, that depending on which of these different areas of focus you're looking at any given time, you might make a different prototype or a different simulation in order to get after improvements in each of those areas. And we used to make Dyson was a fantastic example. They have this approach to prototyping that forces their whole industrial design language, really, and it all is driven from an unwritten approach to prototyping, where they ask you to make it in cardboard first, right? No CAD.
Right.
If you've got an idea for anything, go and make it in cardboard. And it's fast, it's cheap, it's really accessible to any designer. Doesn't require lots of tools and equipment, right? It's like a scalpel and some glue and that's it. And they, you know, they develop techniques for making radiused edges, and like the intricacy that I've seen in the Dyson prototyping labs for cardboard prototypes is absolutely incredible, to the point where they're making cones and they're making spheres and they're making cylinders and, you know, chamfered edges and all sorts of detail, right? And the interesting thing with that is that it forces the design language to be based on primitives. And so you'll notice that Dyson has a very distinctive design language, but it's not a top down, like, here's a design Bible, you shall, you know, do this and that. Yeah. It's driven by the approach to prototyping, which I find like absolutely fascinating. Dyson is a very closed company. They don't, you know, they do a lot of the development internally, a lot of user testing internally. Shark was the absolute opposite. So Shark was like, okay, we're going to go and ask our customers what they think of any prototype, right? So at every level of prototyping, right from the earliest, we've got some sketches, right? Like pencil sketches. Yeah. Maybe they've been, you know, cleaned up a little bit, and they've had some line work done on them, and they've had some render, you know, not computer renders, but like artistic renders. We'd go and talk to people with a set of images and a set of things that we might write on the box about performance or, you know, ease of use or any particular feature. And you go and test those with people and ask them their opinion. And that within Shark would drive a lot of the, should we do this or should we do that, was driven by the voice of the customer reacting to early prototypes at any, you know, everything from sketches through foam models, through, you know, painted ID models, through, you know, when we start getting into working prototypes, those working prototypes would also be tested with consumers. They would be, you know, as they get closer to production, they would be left with consumers in the home for 30 days, you know, like just getting a proper read on what they saw as valuable, you know, features would be ranked, and you'd almost ask the customer to say, well, what would you spend your money on? Would you like feature A, feature B, feature C? And you get a really good handle on how the product's going to perform in the market, off the shelf, how it's going to perform in the home, what customers are going to like about it. And that's all enabled by prototyping. simulation can't do any of that, right? Like it can't get you to those kind of softer insights. But simulation allows you to confidently predict the performance before you start prototyping. So I see it as a way of digitally prototyping to gain confidence so that as an engineering group, you can say to your product team, well, yes, we think we can deliver 50% more suction or you know, 20% better cleaning. And you've got to be able to say that with confidence, because when you're in that really ambiguous early stage, you can't just promise the world, right? You can't, marketing will want everything, right? Do you want more, do you want more suction? Yes. Do you want lighter weight? Yes. Do you want XY better cleaning? Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So at some point you have to say, we think we can deliver this for this price. And that's where simulation comes in early. And we used to use simulation a lot for both looking at the layout of components and the air pathways between them, but then also fine tuning things like we used to put handle batteries in the handles and things like that, right, to try and put the mass where really close to the hand to make it feel light. And when you do that, then you have temperature issues to deal with. And so we used to use simulation to try and make sure that there were no hot spots on the handles and that it was at a comfortable temperature. And that would get, you would build test rigs to go and test with customers to confirm the simulation and stuff like that. So I definitely, the vacuum cleaner industry and any kind of technically complex consumer product where the customer has to interact and use the product both as an ergonomic, but also has to have some kind of performance. Like you've got to do all types of prototyping and simulation all together at different phases in order to get the answers that you need at the right time.
Yeah, I think that that convergence of the ergonomics and the human factors with the internal engineering and innovative, like, integrating that form factor that is functional at the same time as being obviously usable to the customers is a challenge for a lot of teams. I think, in my opinion, I've seen and worked with teams where you have disparate competing evidence to converge on a product, and oftentimes depending on how it's weighted, right? I think that there's different weighting metrics to each one of these as well, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can speak to how, in a lot of organizations, engineering is over here, design is over here. They kind of create in their silos, if you will, and then kind of have touch points and milestones where we all make a prototype together or something and see what's working and what's not.
Yeah.
But oftentimes you come up against, I'll call it a clash for lack of a better word, between a competing performance metrics, whether it's, the handle's ergonomics, but the weight needing to be a certain weight or distribution at the same time.
Yeah. Can you talk lucky.
Yeah,
I've been so lucky in my career that I have not worked in those silos. The companies that I've worked at, when I've been doing product design, have been acutely aware that even to the point of job descriptions, your job description was design engineer, right? If you came from an art background, like pure art, fine art, illustration, if you came from a pure engineering background, doesn't matter. Everybody was design engineers. And what that did was it flattened the hierarchy so that there was no us and them, right? Everybody had a common title.
Yes.
And secondly, it empowered everybody to say, well, actually my job is to influence the engineering, even if you've come from a fine art background, and vice versa, right? As engineers, like from a personal perspective, I've struggled a little bit with, I think, making beautiful things. And in that I have my own sort of, like, I have an attempt at making something that that, you know, like when I look at it in the computer or like I make a prototype, that you know, I have my own aesthetic judgment. But like when I see somebody who's actually got some talent, like do the same job or takes my underlay, and then you see people make things that are so much more beautiful than you know, it's just a different skill set, right? So
right.
It yep. means that like every job is everybody's responsible for all aspects, right? And it empowered everybody to speak up about like, this should be better or that should be better. And you never had like, that's not my job or like, you know, my job's this. Yep. So I think that's been immensely powerful. And also like the co-location of people, like I've been lucky in that as engineer, like I come from an engineering perspective, I might be looking at the arrangement of the internal components, right? Like for best weight distribution or like for best airflow through the device or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Working like where you're sat next to the guy that's designing the skin, for want of a better word, like the shape and the part, you know, the color breaks and the part splits and you know, even getting down to like where are we, what are we doing with the screws, and you know, all of that kind of the design part of it, like being able to sit next to the guy so that you're sharing the same CAD even at the underlay stage, and you know, you can come and sit in on all of the sketch hacks where you know, you're taking the underlay and there's 50,000 sheets of paper of the underlay printed and everybody's sketching on top. Like it's been really, really nice to be part of an inclusive product design. Like, and product design isn't just about like one discipline, right? Like to have a successful product design, you've got to have engineering and legal and marketing and, you know, industrial That's design right. and, you know, all of this, right? So it's all of the teams that I've worked on have been very, very small design teams of, you know, less than six people responsible for a product, even if that product then is, you know, making hundreds of millions of dollars for company XYZ and being manufactured at huge scale. And you know, when I say it's half a dozen people, I'm talking about the early product definition phase. Obviously, there's a much bigger team that is needed to get things into mass production at a later phase. And there's a lot of the design, you know, a lot of the design work happens in those later stages. So, you know, this early team that is responsible for the product vision and getting it onto the roadmap, you know, those people stay with it to ensure that the vision is seen through into production. But, you know, the touch points with the design become more about like course correcting as you get closer to mass production rather than like wholesale changes in the layout or the form or the design, which happens early on. But yeah, I've not experienced the silos. So like,
Well, so I want to, that there's a lot to unpack and a number of points you made there. I want to back up just for a minute about the comment you made about the flat teams. And this was definitely prevalent at Amazon when we were working on the dash card. And, you know, we went from, I think when I was hired, it was myself and 12 engineers. And then we ramped up in a year to 70 engineers and multiple facets of teams broke out with firmware and software and hardware. But we all worked on the same floor in the same giant open room, and you could walk over to someone's desk and say, "Hey, you know, Andre, you know, what are you working on? And we'll check this out." And just like this very serendipitous kind of interaction where you can run into people and exchange ideas. And I think it goes a long way to being able to iterate and conceptualize together quickly and to remove, as you mentioned, kind of some of those gotchas later on down the line where the harmony of the form and the necessity of the engineering don't clash at O-100, right? And that's a super powerful process. It reminds me of this technique that when I used to consult doing industrial design work for CPG companies, we used to bring like a number of managers together in a room, and we would do a training day. You know, half of the first day would be a training day. We'd bring them through some different techniques in brainstorming process. And one of the techniques is used a lot in a stand-up, not stand-up comedy, that's the improv comedy. And it's the yes and. And so this yes and technique, when you're brainstorming or at the nascent conceptual development stages, where you're regardless of disciplines, as you mentioned, you know, you're building upon everyone's idea simultaneously to create the thing later. And it's this very unified, it can be very kind of, you know, you jump back and forth quite a bit, right? But that ultimately will conclude with a better design in the long run.
We used to do these week long design sprints where you would have, you know, a team of six people, cross discipline, one from each department.
Right.
And the managers would come in midweek, or they'd come in at the start, right? They'd set the stage. This is what the business wants to do. We want to get into this sector, right? And leave it fairly open. And then they would be like, they would come in, you know, midway through, and then they would come in at the end. And one of the levelers that I thought was really good was just the sketching of ideas on post-it notes with stick figures. And it's something as silly as that, right? Like where you force everybody to draw with the same level of resolution. There's often this barrier where I think when you like, certainly for me, I'm an engineer that sketches, like my sketches are engineering led, right? They're more likely to be orthographic views. They're more likely to be like cross-section views of wall thicknesses and things like that, right? So when I go and talk to a designer, someone that can sketch beautifully in perspective, and like it's a little intimidating, right, to go and sketch in front of somebody who you know is a better sketcher than you. And so this method of like everybody sketches their ideas in a simplistic way firstly helps break down those barriers. It allows managers and non-technical people to contribute ideas, because they may have different insights, right, than you as an engineer or a designer, or and it then allowed like the managers to also get involved in that process, and you know, to have a discussion around all of the ideas without like the best you know, the best sketch appearing to come to the top because it's a good quality sketch, or the loudest person coming to the top because they talk over everyone else, or things like that. I like that idea of breaking down everybody's the same contribution to the process. You might come with different background, but like you don't want any one to be too dominant, I don't think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's that's a really awesome technique. I like the fact that you brought to the point of drawing while you were brainstorming. And so besides kind of the stick figure, kind of low fidelity drawing and having everyone be included in that process, I think there's something also that's something to be said about drawing as you're telling the story of what your idea is, because everyone can explain a thing. Like if I were to describe a product to you and have you draw it, but there's 20 other people in the room drawing that what I'm describing, there's going to be 20 different drawings of what I've described. But when you're having this conversation with a group of people and you're all iterating and drawing the idea as you're talking through it, it also helps to kind of guide and direct as well. And I know it's a super kind of low, I was going to say low fidelity technique, but it's super accessible technique to anyone to brainstorm, whether you're a designer, engineer, even a firmware guy or algorithms, for instance.
So just in the last year, I've started playing with this with the Oculus Quest, and using a software called Gravity Sketch, which is you know, it's a design focused 3D sketching. I'll call it a 3D sketching, but it's actually a 3D form development tool in virtual reality, and I had a really interesting session with a VP where he had this idea and he wanted it. He couldn't quite articulate it properly, not properly, but he couldn't articulate it to the people that he had talked to, where they would understand and translate his idea into what he wanted, right? And so what we actually did was we did a live design session where it was it was really interesting. I had screencast the what I could see inside my Oculus Quest to his screen,
yep.
you know, across the other side of the country. And we had an hour where I would be designing in real time in 3D, and he would be describing, and then as he was describing, I was creating form, and then he was responding to that in real time, and then I was adjusting the form. And it was enabled because the tools had got to the point where real-time design had allowed for that. And, you know, previously I would be, like when I did my race car, I was designing in 3D in like SolidWorks, and, you know, my customer was sat next to me. You know, we were at the point where he was able to see and influence the design in real time. But like, coming into virtual reality has just taken that totally to another level, and it's enabled by the tools being so responsive, and you know, the speed at which you can generate form is just incredible now. And I think that's really going to change how people go about exploring designs. You know, we were even exploring taking those virtual designs and turning them into prototypes. Which, you know, like you're starting to get,
can export out of Gravity Sketch.
Yeah, you're starting to get to the point where you can print directly from these kind of conceptual tools, which again, like 3D printing has traditionally been like, okay, you've got to generate some CAD, and you know, that might be an engineering based CAD, or it might be a design based CAD. But even then, like, it was fairly laborious to generate the 3D form to any kind of like resolution where you'd want to print it. But I think that's going to be changing. And I think these kind of conceptual tools and how you then can go straight to printing, which then brings back into the engineering performance side of testing. You can test those prototypes, like starts to merge it all together into a real time product development workflow, which I hadn't really appreciated the power of that until, you know, you're sitting with a manager and you're able to do something in real time. Like that was immensely valuable.
Yeah, that's the speed at which you can move nowadays with some of that is amazing, and that's a great example, Andre. I wonder if so there's another facet in Gravity Sketch which I know you're very familiar with, is that you can import and build around objects that you've modeled and essentially, I'll say, remove the CAD goggles and see things in one-to-one relationships.
Yeah, I think
I'm wondering if you could talk through about that a little bit.
So yeah, I actually did some development of some of the trucks that I've been working on in Gravity Sketch, and it's not really an automotive focused design tool, but I was basically bringing in the underlay components, so mechanical hardware. As objects, and it's right at the very early stages of that being a workflow that Gravity Sketch is, you know, has focused on. So it's a little bit clunky at the moment, I would say, but like you can bring in geometry. It's kind of fixed at that point. Like you can't really interact with it too much other than placing it somewhere. But it does allow you to you know, generate surfaces that can wrap it, in a much more intuitive way than doing it on a flat CAD screen. I think the real power is going to come when you're doing that. And I don't know if this will be through some, like I've really struggled to, sorry, I'm not making a lot of sense here. I think it's going to be a lot better when it's an augmented reality design experience rather than fully virtual. I think that certainly when you're designing products that people are going to touch and use and interact with, and they're going to be in the home, like to be able to have that if you imagine an augmented experience where you have a physics engine behind there, right? And there's you can see your environment, you can have, you know, things in your hand that you're using in your environment. I think like designing in that environment is going to be a lot better than designing in a fully virtual environment. Because certainly things like the trucks where they're really big things that you're working on, but like traditionally you on a CAD screen, you like shrink it all down and you're working, you wouldn't know whether you're working on a scale model or the full size thing. Like you have no idea. When you go to virtual reality, you still kind of have that, right? Like you don't work on it at one-to-one scale. You actually work on it like at the scale where you can see the radius, or you can move the control points or whatever. Yeah. So I think that's still a little bit of a step that needs to improve, is like, how do you design? And certainly for consumer appliances and things that where one-to-one scale is kind of the scale that you'd be drawing at anyway, like Dyson, we always used to work with one-to-one scale cross-section views, and all of the development would be done in cross-section.
Oh, interesting.
And you'd review physical drawings, and you know, we used to have to like color code all of the wall thicknesses so that you could instantly see the stack up of different wall thicknesses and the air paths and the, you know, the all of the different components. I think that for those types of one-to-one scale products, then I think that an augmented experience is going to be a lot better for design. But you can't really, there's no software that I've seen anyway that is allowing for design in a HoloLens type device, right? Everything seems to be virtual at the moment, and the HoloLens is more for like, okay, well, you've got your geometry and now you deploy it into augmented reality and you can inspect it or interact with it, but it's not really about creating it in that augmented space. And I think that will be really a good step once those sort of softwares start. And pass through is coming, right, with the Quest, and it's getting better and better. But I think that, I would like to, you know, to be able to do things like make a hand sculpted handle as a physical thing, and then bring it into an augmented space and be able to sculpt surfaces around it, right, that move when I move the handle, right? That would be a particularly compelling use case for an augmented reality design generation tool.
Yeah, no, I could totally envision that, where you could literally wrap your hand around the thing you just made to see, you know, to check check the human factors relationship to that thing immediately.
Yeah,
that immediate feedback. Interesting. Yeah. So you alluded to you briefly mentioned the race car, and I want to just dig into this just for a second, because I think it's super exciting. Is this the Skyrunner that you worked on?
No, that's the flying
car.
Different,
is this the race car?
I'll just throw that away. No, the race car is one that I did with a chap called Adrian Reynard, who's you know, a well-established race car designer, constructor, engineer, you know, had a company that had won the Indy 500 and stuff like that. So I designed with him. He was a mentor figure for me, and together we designed a car from the ground up. So all the components, you know, we didn't design the engine, but like we did a lot of engine modifications, but all of the chassis, suspension and bodywork and electrical and things like that. So that was one.
And those files are available. I think I did a little research before we were chatting. It looks like some of those files are available still on GrabCAD, or what's the
so,
the website?
So I had visions of like thinking that open source could apply to hardware, right? And you know, open source software is such a big movement, and it's so immensely useful to everybody. I had visions of like, you know, what would it be like if you just think about the intellectual property that's locked up in engineering drawings, right? Like how to make stuff, and you think that none of that is available, right? It's all proprietary. Like everybody's, for every product that exists, somebody's made a drawing, really. Like for every building, for every car, like there's drawings and there's CAD for all of these products. And none of them are available to help other people learn how to design products, right? So this is something that I still can't believe, like the amount of information that is lost to humanity, really, because how to make things to the right tolerance, to the right material, to, you know, to the right shape, like, or how did you make that? Like it sits locked away in CAD servers, and that information is not passed down to future generations of engineers, right? So like the only way for engineers and designers to create new products is to go through this learning process of trying to make something and then working out where you went wrong, or like looking at, you know, you join a company and find out how the company has historically made things. And I wanted to, you know, provide some access to future engineers and designers to, you know, learn from what I had done, right? Like I spent a good few years of my life making this car, and I created all of this CAD, and I had a full supply chain, and I had all of these engineering drawings and 3D models and simulations and wind tunnel data and, like, you know, suspension calculations, everything. And it was of no value just sitting with me, right? Like it was no value to anybody else. Like it was only valuable if you were going to make more of those cars,
right?
And so I thought, like, it would be really good if I just open sourced it. And I think it was the first open source race car that anyone had done. This is back in 2008 2009, and so just published everything and let people make it. And, you know, people have been making it in Sweden and Russia and Italy, and the car and the molds are now, we built a couple of cars. I think they built another 10 in Italy. The molds are now in New Zealand. So, like, and, you know, we've done a number of student projects where having full access to all of that data has enabled the students to then, you know, go and design new things or to simulate new things, and research projects on, like, improving the cooling. Or, like, even the other day I had some guy, on Facebook was like, oh, I downloaded your CAD and I made some improvements to the wing position and I did some simulation and here are the files, and I think you could make it, you think you could make it go faster next time. It's just kind of cool. Like,
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like,
I
like the idea of, like, I've benefited so much from, like, open source software where you have access to tools, right, that, like, just speed up your workflow, or things where features have been implemented by people. And I wondered what it would be like if you could get to the point where any piece of hardware also had similar, and I'm not talking about PCBs, because, like, PCBs and, like, little cameras and, you know, Raspberry Pis and stuff are all open source, right? But from the hardware perspective, like, they're not big complicated products, right? Like they're small devices. And I just wanted for people to be able to learn from, like, okay, this is all of the things that go into making a complex thing like a car. And so it's all out there.
Now I know that, I saw, like, as I mentioned, I did come across it in one of the CAD sharing platforms. But I'm wondering, do you have other information baked into those models, or how are you transferring some of the information that you're talking about that gets locked away to people when they download the parts? Is it just inherently embodied within each one of those models?
So
what other features?
So there's a full 3D model. So there's multiple layers.
Yep.
Firstly, there's an assembly of all the parts, right? So you can, that, you know, it's in parasolid format, it's CAD neutral. You can download it and open it and you'll get it comes with the full assembly structure and all the part names and things like that. So, like, it's pretty good if you want to just explore around and you want to open up a sub assembly. the way that you organize then the folder structure. I think I've just, can you still hear me through the AirPods or is it through the?
That's okay. Yeah, I got
it. I think it's coming through the car now, but.
That's all right.
The way that you organize and you name your parts allows people to then dive from the 3D into the 2D engineering drawings, which have the same part naming convention, right? So you can open up any subassembly and then open up the drawing for that subassembly or the parts within that subassembly and then dive into the individual parts and see, you know, all of the dimensional data for that part. And, you know, I think that, like, those then all obviously go to the bill of materials and the suppliers who could make those parts. And what I had envisaged was a way of, okay, I've got this part, and you could then, because it's open and shareable, you can have quotes from the entire world's supply chain. You know, maybe a race car is not the right product because it's not high volume, but you could imagine a case where, let's use the vacuum cleaner as an example. I wanted to make a vacuum cleaner. I've designed it. And if I shared all of the CAD, any supplier could quote on making that, right? It's not then protected. It doesn't require me to go to a supply chain and say, please, can you quote on this? Which is how we do things today, right? We have a supply chain team. We have, you know, relationships with certain vendors, and you send them some data and they will send you back a quote. What I want, I as a single person designer, I really struggle to stay on top of, like, okay, I've sent it out to 5 suppliers for this one part to quote, and then you have to chase them for the quote, and then you have to, like there was so much involvement of my time just trying to get quotes to make things. I thought, well, why am I trying to find suppliers to then give them business? Why aren't they trying to find me and, you know, quote in order to win my business, right? I thought, like, it would be really good if the designs were shareable and you weren't protective about it. You could have quotes from anyone all around the world could come in, and you could say, okay, I want to make this race car in America, and I want to make it in New Zealand, and I'm going to make it in the UK. And you could effectively have a supply chain that was an onshore, you know, supply chain for making the things that you want in the local market that you were in. And it would require not a lot of effort from my perspective, right, as the designer, because, you know, the quotes would come in, and somebody who wanted to build that car could, like, review the suppliers that had quoted for quality or geography or price or delivery speed or whatever, right? Like, and they could select where they wanted to get it. But, like, I thought this would be a really powerful way of having hardware made locally, for local markets with local supply chain without the overhead of having to stand each of those up individually.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that paints a great picture of kind of where your head is at with some of that stuff. And I wonder, so to coin an Amazon leadership principle, I guess, think big. You definitely do a lot of that. And you probably rank pretty high when it comes to the quarterly and yearly reviews when people vote on those leadership principles. But I'm wondering, do you have any other techniques or processes for thinking big when it comes to engineering or design? Like, where do you find inspiration in that process?
I think the earliest, like, one of my big concerns was that coming out of university that I was going to get stuck designing, like, a door handle for, you know, as part of a massive team. and like, that scared me, right? So, like, a lot of my early career was focused on trying to do everything just to get a bit of a, like, I liked the idea of knowing a little bit about a lot of things. And that's actually, like, in retrospect, it's quite a daunting career path for young engineer or a designer to think that they're going to defer
getting a job as a junior engineer or designer in a big company.
Right.
I think if you do go and get that job, right, like it's financial security, it's like, okay, something on your CV, it's an intro to a job market, you get to learn from other people in a big company, right? There's a lot of advantages or perceived advantages. I didn't want to go in and design a little widget as part of a bigger team. And so that scared me. I felt like I was getting locked into becoming a specialist way too early. And so I think my thinking big approach actually stems from that, where I said, okay, I'm just going to try and design the whole thing myself. And it may or may not be successful, but at least I will learn from each of the different aspects, right? I'll learn a little bit about wiring looms, or I'll learn a little bit about like designing mold tooling or like whatever it is. And when you have an appreciation for all the different areas, that then sets you into a thinking big like mindset right from the start, right? So you train your brain to think about all of the aspects, which is really what design is all about, is having empathy for all of the different disciplines. If I was to say what is good design, it's knowing how to prioritize and balance the different competing KPIs, or you know, the different things that are important for at any given time. Like, and different products have different balances. Like it's like the old graphic equalizers, right? Like you've got all of these different knobs and levers that change how the product comes out at the end. And so as a designer, if you can't understand the importance of any one given lever, right, if you don't take an interest in all of the aspects, then you're likely to be narrow in your design approach, such that your end result doesn't like fully deliver like where it could, right? Because you might not have thought too much about cost, or you might not have thought about structural integrity, or you might not have thought about like, you know, how you're going to apply this texture in the tool, like whatever the decision point. And the way you mentioned it earlier, the weighting, how you weight the importance of each of these decisions is absolutely critical to the end result of the product design. And if you don't have experience in trying or experience or exposure to those different disciplines, you are not going to be able to design a cohesive whole product. So I think the thinking big just comes from a desire to know a little bit about a lot of things. And that then gives you a voice in all of those design decisions. And that then appears like you're thinking big. But I just think of it as not wanting to think small. Like,
you know, what it sounds like you're talking about too is like approaching different methods, right? Because each lens that you look through, whether it's the engineer or the supply chain or whatnot, there's a method to how they approach and succeed at the goal of their task, right? And it, you know, when I was a young designer, even still in college, I was researching different methods and approaches to how to design. You know, it wasn't always just one way or one avenue or route. It's not necessarily always just talking to a customer. Maybe it's the approach of making something more efficient by leveraging biomimicry or understanding life cycle analysis so that you could reduce the overall environmental impact of a product from the beginning when you're designing it from its material selections, et cetera, et cetera. And I think having, you know, it's a skill, though, that it develops over time. As you mentioned, it's not something that, well, the naivety when you come out of college is that you're kind of, you want to try to do it all, or maybe you don't want it, maybe you do want to specialize in something. But I think that there is some lessons to be learned that happen over time, and to not be afraid of just continuing to adapt and learn with the teams that you're involved with.
I would say that one of the most valuable things that I've done throughout my career is jump around from within different disciplines. And it gives you a really unique insight into the problems and the types of solution, or the, you know, the different approaches in those different industries, right? And those are immensely applicable in things that you didn't, you know, when you get into a new environment, you can apply a breadth of knowledge. I think that's really important for designers to expose themselves. It's why consultancies are so good, as you know, if you have different types of projects coming in, I think that's a really, you know, a really good fertile environment for young engineers and designers to like expose themselves to different industries and different solutions and different problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't want to cut our chat too short, but I want to be respectful of your time, Andre. I appreciate it. But I'm not going to let you get away from this interview without talking about the flying car for a minute. We actually haven't chatted about it even since we've known each other, and I'm curious if you can tell us a story of how that came to be.
So I was at Dyson, and the guy that had hired me into Dyson, part of the interview panel, came to me one day and was like, "Oh, I've got a friend, and he's looking for somebody to design and build this a flying car. And like, I thought of you, and you know, would you be interested in meeting him?" So I went and met him at the pub, and you know, we had a great chat. And turned out he had an investor in the US, and you know, he needed somebody to turn this idea into reality. And they had a year to do it. And I went home that evening and said to my wife that I think I'm going to go and make a flying car. And she looked at me. Well, she knows that I'm crazy, so like there wasn't no surprises there. But like, basically, gave up a well-respected design job at a great company. Dyson was awesome, and went to a startup where it was me and a fabricator. And we had to deliver a flying car in a year. So, yeah, don't be afraid to do crazy stuff, because when you push yourself outside of what you thought you could do, like, you know, you find ways to, invariably you find ways to do most
make
of it.
It happen.
Like, there are things that I would do better, but the flying car was definitely a better product. Like, it was a lot. Yeah, it was after I'd done the race car, so I had a lot to leverage in terms of how I approached it.
Right.
The tools that I would use, the supply chain, I like had a lot of connections in the industry that could make things for me quickly. I had a lot of CAD, like to even as building blocks, right? Like, and so it was a lot more efficient as a process. Like things went straight from you know, the computer to us, you know, go and digitally laser cut these tubes. And, you know, a week later we had a chassis. Like that was a lot faster.
Wow.
You know, the race car was a lot more handmade, even though we had CAD and designs. It was like, okay, you got to set this tube up in, and we're going to, you know, chop through it with a hole saw. And like, it was a lot more, tools had moved on, and digital fabrication was a lot better as well. So, yeah, it was really good. And then we shipped it over to Florida and in a box, and I assembled it. We launched it at a boat show, a super yacht show in Florida, and it arrived like in the parking lot in a shipping container in pieces. And I was there with my like tool bag, right? Like in the parking lot, assembling a car.
Just putting this thing together.
And then we put it on the dock next to these super yachts, and it was great. It was fantastic experience. And yeah.
That's awesome. Holy cow. Well, people can check that out in the show notes. I'll grab a link and obviously attach any other handles and such that you have, Andre. Where can people go to learn more about you, follow you, keep in touch?
I don't know. I've stayed away from like having too much of a personal profile out there, other than I expect LinkedIn is probably my, like, if people want to chat, I'm more active on LinkedIn than I am on anything else. I really should do a little bit
better
on like having more of a like design portfolio type, like explaining how I've gone about like creating certain products that, you know, I'm particularly proud of the Dyson robot. I did all of the mechanical design and the layout, and like there's some fantastic things that have stayed through the subsequent generations of Dyson robot where they've kept the same layout. That makes me proud. But yeah, I should really do more of a portfolio page that sort of explains the design thinking behind, you know, why does this product that I worked on look like that, and what reasons and what innovations sure. enabled it, and you know, explain a little bit more about the process that I've gone through.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why we're interviewing you today, Andre. I mean, we're just going to unravel it here.
If you've got two more minutes, that was a really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when I started on the Dyson robot, like all robots, home robots, home vacuum cleaners have this bumper, right, that goes around the front of the product. And, you know, they drive around and they have an array of sensors and things. And, you know, sometimes the sensors miss objects, right? And so they put this bumper on there so that, like, if they hit into anything, they can have a physical micro switch that goes off and says you've hit into something, right? And you might have more than one okay. micro switch, and you might know which direction you need to back away from that thing. But in general, that makes all the robots look the same, right? They've all got this big wraparound bumper on the front, and like from a design perspective, they're very vanilla, right? They're hockey puck. They're yeah. everything looks the same, and it just and Dyson have this technology, right? Like that they've always had on all their vacuum cleaners is all cyclones, right? Cyclones are round. All robot vacuum cleaners have square, like they're basically sweepers with a little bit of suction assist, and they sweep into a square little tray, and you lift the tray out from behind some cover or something like this, right?
Yep.
So they're all the same. All the other vacuum cleaners are the same. Dyson's like known for its cyclones. In all their other products, the cyclone is front and center, right? So how do you enable that on a robot that needs to have a bumper? This is one of the cases where I had to really fight hard in order to take a risk. And the idea was one that had come to me. I'd seen, I think it was a Pininfarina car design where they had taken inspiration from an egg. Now, this sounds like a totally like round about the houses way to get to a solution for robot vacuum cleaners, but this is exactly my point about like immerse yourself in all types of solutions to problems, right, in different industries.
Mm-hmm.
An egg has an important bit in the middle, which is the yolk, and it's suspended in a secondary fluid medium, which is the white part around the yolk, and that's then protected with a hard shell around the outside, right? So if an egg hits something, the yolk moves within the egg, right? There's no bumper on it on an eggshell, right?
Yes, yeah, of course.
So the movement, the give, you have to have movement against a spring and a damper in order to dissipate the energy, right? So without movement, your peak accelerations are really high, right? Because you have no time to slow down. So in an egg, that's how nature solved this problem of how to protect something. Now, Pininfarina thought, like, hey, that's a great idea. Why do cars crumple? Eggs don't crumple, right? Like, if an egg crumples, then it's failed, right? So, in nature, they solved this problem by having the movement happen internally. Pininfarina thought, hey, that's a great idea for a car. Why don't we have the the seats on an internal sled, right? And have the car shell be really rigid so that if you hit into something, the seats give, right? And the whole thing moves. And that kind of happens a little bit with like steering wheels and things like that. But they took it to another level, and they had the whole seats move on a sled, just like the yolk of an egg. I had seen this having been interested in cars and like interesting ideas and biomimicry, stuff like that. And I thought, well, what would it be like if you had your robot have a rigid outer shell and then have a bunch of the internal components like the drive systems and the batteries and the air pathways and stuff move inside the outer shell, right? So the outer shell becomes your bumper effectively, but it's all the way around the outside. And so when you do that, it means like your design can get cleaned up because you don't have to have a movable bumper and part gaps and like, you know, all of this messiness that happens with current bumpers. You know, they have to allow like 10 millimeters. So I advocated to totally remove the bumper and turn the entire outside of the robot into a rigid outer shell and then have the insides move and then contact microswitches so that you could slow down the inside and there were springs and microswitches and things like that. And so that became a patentable feature. The other thing that it allowed was the entire cyclone to be part of the rigid outer body, right? So that allowed the cyclone to be where the bumper used to be, which totally changed the industrial design of the product and allowed for this really cool, well, I think it's cool. It was also in the Museum of Modern Art, which
clean approach. Yeah.
But if you look at it from plan view, it's a circle with another overlapping circle for the cyclone that sort of intersects the wider outer circle. It was a design that was copied by some other large Japanese and Korean electronics companies, which made me chuckle. I went to CES one year and I'm not going to name names, but there was a large, they make TVs and other consumer goods, but they had basically totally ripped off the design, and that there was nothing more pleasing as a designer to have rip off the design. But it has this idea of having the part that the customer needs to take off the product, right? You don't want to hide it behind a mechanical system that is not serving the ease of access, right? To empty the bin and to see the technology of that is different, like, was really important to be able to show it at the front of the product to say our product is different because it has a cyclone. Here is the cyclone. It's easy to get to. You don't have to open a trap door to get the, you know, dirt out and stuff like that. Like, all of those things were really good reasons. I had to advocate really hard because the risk was that you would not be able to sense the bump quickly enough and you would bump into things and damage things, right? So we had a lot of proving out of like, can you slow down quickly enough? Can you make the bump soft enough so that you cannot damage furniture and other things that you might bump into? And that was quite a hard sell, you know, to a robotics team that wanted to rely on a bump signal. It ended up creating a really unique industrial design that's quite clean and pure. You know, it's two circles, and then like fortuitously there was also a camera that was in the middle, so you ended up with a large outer circle, a smaller overlapping circle that was approximately half the diameter of the big circle, and then another smaller overlapping circle for the camera that was like, again, it was like this cascading sizes of circles that all overlapped, and it was just really, really nice afterwards. And I can remember sketching it just like three circles, and it was like, and that has persisted. And I'm really proud of, like, you know, that as a example of taking a solution from a totally different industry, from nature, and applying it in a non-obvious way. And the result being something that is unique from a design perspective, but has some real reason to be there from a customer point of view. That's been a really nice project to be involved with, even though I was only involved in it for, you know, the very early phases of like creating the, you know, P1s and P2 prototypes, laying out all the components. And, you know, there's a lot of other people that took that product and solved all of the problems that I created in trying to get it to market. But yeah.
Wow. Yeah. From egg to race car to home robot vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
I tell you, that's just, it's a perfect example of biomimicry, but also, as you mentioned, a perfect example of exploration outside of your realm, outside of the categories.
We made a clear outer shell, and then all you can see all of the components inside and the yep. springs and stuff. And we made and a little
deceleration
radio. We made a radio control, yep. Like, so you could drive it into things and you can see it hit into things and you can see them, all the insides move. And it's just like, oh yeah, that's so satisfying.
Oh, that's perfect. That's awesome. Well, how about one more question here, Andre? I'm curious to know what excites you right now in any realm. It could be methods, it could be design, it could be engineering, it could be new technology. I mean, I'll let you go with it.
I touched on it earlier. I'm super excited about augmented designing in yep. an augmented way. I think that those tools are coming on. I follow quite closely, like the photogrammetry and the. Oh, actually, the thing that really is that I haven't dived into this.
Yes.
It's called procedural design, and it's used a lot in people that make game environments. So it's in software like Blender, right, where you can it's kind of like you've got these mathematical models and you've got nodes that you can connect different yep. aspects, right? You've got shaders, you've got geometry, you've got yep. rendering, you've got all of that, right? And you can basically tune your sliders and tune your math models yep. and then connect different inputs to outputs. And I haven't even started doing it, but the things that I see people do when they are procedurally creating game environments, or they're making buildings, or they're making pipe layouts, or they're making, and you just see, and these things like magically grow from, you know, the definition within the software.
Yep.
I'm really interested in, could that be applied to physical things that you want to make, right? At the yes. moment, they're being applied to create, you know, these fantastically rendered meshes and geometries. But I'm interested in, could that be applied to physical product designs?
Well, so this you're talking about, so this is something I use quite a bit in Grasshopper and yep. Rhino. Have you? Yeah.
Yeah.
So
no, it's like I've seen some of your
parametric modeling.
Yeah. So yep. So that's an application to, like, okay, I've got a repeating pattern of holes or like little valleys or yep. like whatever, right? But yep. that's like the first step into procedural product yep. design. I'm interested in, like,
but
could you design like the air paths for a vacuum cleaner procedurally? Could you design?
Yeah.
Like, if you took like a complex product that has all of these different design elements, some of which have engineering and mathematical models that define them or yeah. define what's good, could you layer all that together into something and yeah. spit out a design at the end that could be printed? I'm really interested in that intersection of algorithmic design, mathematical, like all the engineering can be represented in a physics model, right? Like, so this intersection of mm-hmm. game, render, like simulation, mathematics and physics, and then the experience of designing products. Like there's a whole load of experience that goes in to say, well, this is good, this is not so good, right? Like if you could embody all of that into a procedural algorithm that can help you design products, I think that's going to like rapidly accelerate like product design, I think.
Yeah, I share very much your energy and passion for this approach, because I've been toying recently with, in Grasshopper, you can create equations and relationships between different forms and lines and splines and et cetera, yeah. et cetera. And what that allows you to do is you can create a gross form. Let's say it's like an arc or a shell of some sort, and it's defined by a particular profiles and lofts, which are defined by the, you know, the instances of the nodes of each of those lines. But you can put a slider or some sort of metric to each one of those physical features and move things and scale them and create like infinitely adjustable outcomes or final results on the fly live without having to like model it. And you just bake each one of those, and then you have like a 100 permutations of something that is all relationship and constraint driven.
So if you think about,
like, a product manufacturing model where you're printing those things. As like, you're going to get to the point where people can customize their own products and have them printed and shipped to them, right?
Exactly.
And I'm talking about like vacuum cleaners or things like that, right? Like consumer products. And we haven't got there yet, but I mean, we were at Shark, we were printing, you know, production run with hundreds of prototypes and having them assembled on the production line. And like still in the prototype phase, but having them properly assembled as if they were real tooled parts, right? I think that could be a future, you know, as printing gets better and the materials get better. And, you know, I think that could be really interesting.
Yep.
And then to marry that with algorithmic design, I think that was really exciting for me.
It's going to be wild. It's going to be wild. No, I'd be excited to mess around with you on a project or something like that, creating some sort of ecology of procedural things that, you know, as you move, one thing moves around and then this kind of embodies something a little more. And,
yeah,
you know, whether it's like how the thing is made or how it's put together or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, we've touched on a lot of different stuff, Andre. Again, thank you so much for your time
today.
It's been super, super fun. I'll let you get back to charging your Tesla.
I'm incurring, well, I'm incurring like charging fees now for sitting in the charging bay and not moving.
Oh God. Yeah, all right. You're that guy right now. All right.
Yeah.
Cool, Andre. Thanks so much. We'll be in touch again soon. I'd love to catch up again, maybe catch you on the ski slopes out here in New England.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right.
Cheers, Rob.
See you, Andre. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.